This week on Writers, Inc.
You know, my chapters in the books are always pretty short, kind of like scenes in a film. So you're imagining all that. And once I can play a scene out in my mind with the dialogue and everything, then I'll write it.
J.K. Rowling was nearly homeless when she wrote the first Harry Potter book. Stephen King penned Carrie in a small desk wedged between a washer and dryer. James Patterson worked in advertising and famously crafted the Toys R Us theme song long before becoming an author. Join New York Times bestseller J.D. Barker and a panel of industry powerhouses as they pull back the curtain on some of the world's most prolific authors. Where did they start? What is their process? The biggest names in publishing all have origin stories, all have tips and secrets. What does it take to consistently top the bestseller lists and become a household name? Get your notepad out. School's in session. This is Writers, Inc.
Hi, it's Christine Daigle.
I'm Jenna Brown.
I'm Kevin Tomlinson.
And I'm J.D. Barker. Welcome to Writers, Inc. So I want to talk BookBub, and I was debating whether or not we should talk about this on the air, but I feel like we should. So behind a closed door, I did a BookBub the other day. It came out, I think it was on February 11th. We discounted the book to $1.99. The cost for the BookBub to go out to the thriller list at that price point was a little shy of, I believe it was $1,600. Which basically means, you know, at $1.99, you know, on Amazon, you've got to go to their 30% payout. You know, so when you do all the math, you basically you're making 60 cents per copy. So that means that I would have had to sell 2,667 copies of that book just to break even. And normally with, like, I haven't done a BookBub in a long time. The first one I did was Forsaken. I think I sold like 6,000 copies or something ridiculous, like in a day. But like every time I've done one since then, it's dwindled. It's been like less and less and less. And it's been probably about 2 years since I did one. This one did not sell enough copies to actually pay for the cost. So I wanted to put it out there to the group to see if you guys have done these lately, what you've been hearing on the street, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I've been hearing they're less effective. And we were just kind of talking about this off air because the book we did, Heavier the Stones, made their curated list twice, Best Mystery, Best Adventure. And I didn't see much movement from that either. So I don't think BookBub is as effective as it once was, but I don't know.
The cost has gone up a little, making it even more challenging. But, you know, the last few times that I've gotten a feature deal, they excluded the US list. So, you know, it was much cheaper for me to run, maybe only $200 or $300, but I still didn't get, I barely made even on those on the first day. You get the halo, and so that kind of makes up for it. But my expectations is like, you know, you want to run these, you did a $1.99 one, which I think is also limiting people. Because you know, most of the people on that list want free. I always do the free, and my reasoning behind it is the halo effect has a greater impact on like Amazon in particular. When you know, those freebies, they go and download, and it pushes the book up in the rankings, and then people discover it that way. So you know, once I raise the price, it's still got that nice halo of having been, you know, a bestseller for a couple of days. So that's the strategy I use. And then of course I'm breaking them into a series. So the hope is that they'll buy through.
You said with the last one you did, you didn't break even. What were you at a 99 cent price point or?
Yeah, I did a 99 cent. Yeah. And because okay. I think the problem is you can't use these as an income generator anymore. I mean, there was a time I think when that could work, but it's lost that effectiveness because they've spent so much time curating people who mostly want free. So
yeah, I think that's where the problem is, because it went up by the highest I think I saw it was around 600 in the Kindle store, like the overall store, and then it was number one on a couple of those little sub lists. So you know, Amazon did recognize it, but you know, from my standpoint, like it needs to at least cover its own cost. It doesn't have to be a, you know, an income generator, but it at least needs to pay for itself.
Yeah.
I do think it's more effective with series, particularly longer series, you know, to continue getting readers drawn into the series. Because if I see a brand new book coming out and it's like, oh man, there's 9 books in this series, Like that's kind of a big commitment. But if you give me the first book free or even like 99 cents, like that feels like less of a commitment. Like now I can try it and see if I actually want to continue. It just feels very low risk, but for standalones or, I don't know if that would be as effective. I think it for it to work, you'd have to have, be like a Stephen King or a James Patterson with like, a lot of
So,
books on your backlist or something.
the
I don't know.
challenge is if you're trying to entice people into a series, they generally want to start with number one in the series. And BookBub, if you've had that book in a feature deal a couple of times, they're less likely to choose it for the next feature deal. So even though you're using it as a lead, you may not ever get the deal. So, you do deals on books further in, kind of hoping that they'll read the rest of the series, but I think you're cannibalizing a little.
So I'd be kind of lucky just because, like my titles, people tend to read through, like whether it's a series title or a standalone. The Fourth Monkey series, the first two books were discounted to $1.99 for like the last month by HarperCollins. And I saw people, finishing up that series and then buying the other ones. Like I saw that, it was impacting my standalone titles. It was impacting my other books. So even the books with Patterson, so I'm lucky enough where it does carry through. But I don't know. I mean, I was just disappointed by it in general. Like, it feels like that's just something that's just going away. I think we need to figure out what the next big thing is. All right. What is in the news?
Well, and I'm hoping I'm pronouncing this
Favor.
correctly. Faber, thank you.
You're
Faber
welcome.
comes to the US, or as we Americans say, Faber comes to us. Storied UK publisher Faber has launched Faber US. Faber US plans to put out 40 books this year, with publishers Group West set to handle stateside distribution for the division. Faber previously had a long-standing partnership with FSG on US books, but terminated it in 2015.
Yeah, Faber is a big publisher in the UK. I hear all my UK friends talk about it, and yeah, it interesting because we had Waterstones doing airport books, and now
Yeah.
Faber's coming over too.
It's the British invasion.
British invasion.
Or they will be the new state.
The new state? Yeah, they
The
can
new
be the
state.
51st state. Or
Well,
the
fifth, that'd be
52nd.
50,
Or even
52nd.
Canada alone.
53rd. We're not picky.
I've been dealing with an odd problem coming out of the UK. So my books in the UK are published by, most of them at this point are Simon & Schuster UK. I've got a few with HarperCollins UK. But I've been seeing those editions popping up on the American Amazon sites, which they're not allowed to do. They're not allowed to sell into these cross markets. I'm just bringing it up because I'm not quite sure how to deal with it. I don't want to start stepping on the toes of my foreign publishers, but meanwhile, US publishers have paid to put out these books. They shouldn't be, putting them out in these foreign markets. And if you try to go through Amazon, like I went down the rabbit hole of Amazon support, trying to figure out who to contact just to break the link so it doesn't show up, link to the other books. And it is insane. Like, you basically can't talk to anybody that really knows what they're doing.
Yeah. That sounds on par.
Sounds like Amazon.
Yeah. All right. Next up, they don't call them the Big Five for nothing. The latest issue of Publishers Weekly includes a deep dive into the best-selling books of 2024. Titles from Big Five publishers accounted for 86% of all positions on hardcover fiction and nonfiction lists. There were 1,040 slots available on each list, and Penguin Random House, the biggest of the Big Five, led the pack in both fiction, 366 spots, and nonfiction, 483. Macmillan jumped from its usual position in fifth place up to third, thanks mostly to Kristen Hannah's The Women. Independent publishers had a much better chance to make the trade paperback list, and Source Books once again dominated that format's ranking, claiming 31% of paperback slots. Though majority owned by Penguin Random House, Source Books remains structurally and operationally separate from PRH. This is a huge number, given that Big Five snagged 39% combined. Source Books can thank Book Talk for the win. Books by Freida McFadden accounted for nearly 20% of all paperback bestseller slots. Ah, oh, Book Talk. I would have said maybe that's the answer to the BookBub problem, but who knows what's going to happen.
It is if it wasn't in limbo. I mean, right now TikTok, I don't want to get off on a tangent here, but like TikTok's not available in the app stores anymore.
Yeah.
And that executive order that extended their stay, that's expiring, I believe, at the end of March. And it doesn't look like there's anything going on to actually change that. I've got a couple of takeaways from this. So, the top five have been buying up anybody that's actually producing quality books and making a profit for years, meaning there's really no other competition anymore for them, large enough to be considered competition for for those top five. So that's part of this. And my other takeaway, and I've been hearing this from a couple different sources, it's getting easier to hit a lot of these lists as a paperback than it is as a hardcover. Yeah, I've been noting, like the New York Times list, a lot of the bestseller list, things like this. And the other thing I've been noticing is bookstores themselves, if you put out a title only as a paperback, it's more likely to stay on their shelves a lot longer than if you put it out as a hardcover. If you release a hardcover, typically they'll keep it out there just long enough for that little halo that you had mentioned, the beginning of the sales trend, to take and basically dwindle away, and then they return it if it doesn't sell, in lieu of the paperback that they know is coming, because they can't carry, most stores won't carry both. But if it's only a paperback release, because the cost point for them is a lot lower, they'll buy it, they'll keep it on their shelves a lot longer, and they'll leave it there as a representation of that particular author's work,
Yeah.
which I find very interesting.
That is interesting. I think I wonder if that's going to lead to a kind of s or a strategy of like, if you're not a, I don't know, I don't have a label, a big name author, you get a paperback only release. Like, no, I mean, I know they already kind of do that. There's already a strategy like that, but I wonder if they're going to start leaning in on that as a strategy.
A lot of the big publishers already have. If you talk to anybody that's signing trad deals, a lot of them, or if you
Yeah.
watch Publishers Marketplace, a lot of them are paperback only. Some of them are just ebook only. I'm not sure why somebody would actually sign that, but I'm seeing a lot of those too.
Maybe I'd sign it if I got a bigger royalty and they were handling all the marketing. And you give me like this
Yeah.
a similar royalty what I get to self-publish, but you handle all the marketing. I'll do an ebook only deal. That's basically what I do now.
I'm not sure how much marketing the big publishers are doing though for their authors. I think a lot of
Yeah.
that is landing on the author's shoulders too.
That's where things, I think there's a change a coming. I got inside information on that, but I can't share it now. But tune in
Oh,
to
that's
future
not kind. I've
episodes.
also heard that publishers do less marketing with ebooks just because like it's not like you can tour an ebook or
You could.
no, they see it
signings.
as free money. It's basically, it just adds to their bottom line, but like if it sells one copy or it sells 1,000 or sells zero, it's really no, they
Yeah.
got no skin in the game.
I was just thinking about like, because making visibility in those lists, like physical ARCs are important in that, and you don't get that with ebooks. So I don't know. I've heard them say they do it as like a test, and then if it does well, you might get paperbacks later, but it doesn't seem likely to me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nah.
Anyway,
Things got to change. That's all.
cheery.
That's all I'm going to say. Okay, next up, Hansel and Gretel picture book due this fall from Stephen King and Maurice Sendak. In a surprising announcement and pairing, HarperCollins has announced the fall publication of Hansel and Gretel, a Brothers Grimm reimagining by horror writer Stephen King, illustrated by late Caldecott medalist Maurice Sendak. The picture book will be released on September 2nd. This new edition of the fairy tale classic will feature art originally created by Sendak in 1997 as set and costume designs for the Engelbert Humperdinck opera of Hansel and Gretel. When I saw the pictures, King said, I resolved to give it a try. Two of his pictures in particular spoke to me. One was of the wicked witch on her broom with a bag of kidnapped children riding behind her. The other was of the infamous candy house becoming a terrible face. To me, it was the essence of this story and really all fairy tales. A sunny exterior, a dark and terrible center, brave and resourceful children. In a way, I have been writing about kids like Hansel and Gretel for much of my life. Yes, he has.
Well, I will buy
That is super cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'll have to hide it from my daughter, because she knows Hansel and Gretel. I don't think she knows the Brothers Grimm version of Hansel and Gretel, but
Yeah, I
she's
was
not
gonna
quite
say,
ready
how
for
does
PG-13 yet.
anyone know how that fairy tale actually? The Brothers Grimm did not have a lot of the Happily Ever After didn't exist back then.
No, I don't remember that one. I remember Cinderella was like horrific. People
Yeah.
cutting off like toes and heels. to fit in the slippers and crows pecking out people's eyes. It was not the
Yeah.
Disney version. Not at
No,
all.
no. There's I don't think that there's happy endings in most of them, because the whole point back then was to get children to behave.
Yes.
So they were like, if you do this, you might get your feet cut off.
It's shoved in an oven. I don't know,
This sounds like a one-off, but I'd honestly like to see them do all of them. You know, like I would buy that set and line my bookshelf with all. I don't even know how many there are. But yeah, they're all scary. They're all horrific. They're all graphic. I don't know if horror novels actually existed back at the time when they put these out, but if not, they were basically the genesis of horror novels because they will frighten the bejesus out of you.
Cautionary tales. Love it.
This will be interesting. I don't know how you do something like this with a story like how is Stephen King going to actually quote write it? Like, what is he?
I don't
Is he
know, but
just
I can't wait to find out. I'm
yeah.
totally gonna read that.
He's got other ones. And I should have brought it in here. He's got one about a train. That's a children's book that's based on.
Oh yeah.
Isn't that
Yeah.
From the
that's tied into his Gunslingers or what
yeah.
his Gunslinger novels?
Yeah, I
I
think
can't
so.
remember.
remember the name of the train though. I can only think of Thomas the Train, and that is not
It's not
right.
it's not
Thomas.
Thomas. It looks like Thomas's evil twin
It
cousin or
does.
something.
I
It's
can't. What is the? I don't know. That's gonna drive me crazy. I'm gonna have to look it up eventually.
Charlie
But
the Choo Choo.
what?
Is that it?
Is that it?
That's what came up when I Googled it, but I
It
don't think
might be
that might
like,
be right.
yeah. Yeah. That's. I
Yeah,
don't
from the
think it would
world of
actually
Dark
be.
Tower. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think it would be that much of a stretch actually to do a version of the Grimm's fairy tales. I mean, people have been rewriting Shakespeare for. Ever, it's, and I think a lot of
This is true.
authors use Grimm's fairy tales, maybe not as overtly as this, but I know, I think it'll be. Yep,
Yeah.
there
As
it
says Blaine the Mono.
Playing the mono.
I don't know. Someone will tell us later what the train name is. I
I'm just going by Google. Google said
don't
it.
know.
Charlie
Google's a
the Choo
liar,
Choo,
though. I could be
part of
right.
the Dark Tower
Google is
universe.
very unreliable these
I
days.
have to
Young
tell
kids
you,
are on
the
Google.
whole the Dark Tower books were my favorite Stephen King stories. And the reason is because they're kind of a they're connected to everything else he has ever written. And that was fascinating to me. I stole that idea, blatantly stole that idea from my Sawyer Jackson books. And so now every book I write is somehow connected because of Sawyer Jackson. There's an Easter egg in every book I write now.
Interesting. I like the idea of that, but also like I kind of like the idea of having things like completely separate. So, I mean, I can see the fun in both.
I was writing multiverse books before they were cool. That's all.
Let's see if it eventually ends up on BookBub.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All
Yeah.
right. Okay, JD, who is up this week?
This week we've got DJ Williams on. This guy's bio reads like an adventure movie. He was born in Hong Kong, spent time in the bush of Africa as well as the Middle East. He's an author of young adult fiction. He's hit the number one on Amazon in mystery, suspense, and young adult fantasy. His latest novel is called Battle of Lion Rock and released last month. Here he is, DJ Williams.
DJ Williams, welcome to the show. It's great to have you here.
James, thanks for having me on.
Now, we are going to talk about your new release, but I also want to pick your brains about TV and quite a few other things, and also
Sure.
helping authors. I mean, actually, you're a bit of a renaissance man when it comes to the publishing world. You seem to have got your fingers in a few pies, but shall we talk about the book first of all?
Sure, let's do it.
So you've written, it's number three, isn't it, in the series?
Yeah, it's Battle of Lion Rock is the third book in the Beacon Hill series, and it's been quite an adventure. It was an idea I had about over a decade ago, and at the time we sent it out and nothing happened, so I put it on the shelf and wrote some other books and did some other projects. And a couple of years ago, a buddy of mine approached me, and he said he was just starting out his agency, and he said, "Hey, do you still have that?" And as any good writer does, I'm like, yep, I keep everything, And so I pulled it out, and went through the proposal, rewrote the chapters because I'm like, hopefully I'm a better writer than I was 10 years earlier. And he ended up taking it out, and we sold the series in a couple months to Wander, which was like record time in the publishing world. And now the series I dreamed of writing, now I actually had to write it, which, you know what I mean? You kind of say, be careful what you wish for.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, so I've been writing that series and another series over the last couple of years. And so Battle of Lion Rock is the third in the trilogy. So I'm excited for it to be coming out.
And did you have the series arc in mind when you wrote book one?
You know, what's interesting is I knew exactly how it would start. I knew how the series would end. And then everything in the middle has just been part of like kind of the writing journey. When we sold the series, I had put a treatment together in the proposal for what all, it was four books originally. We got it down to three. I said, here's what's going to go in all three books. And by the time I finished Hunt for Eden Star, which was book one, almost everything in the treatment was in the first book.
Right.
So literally, when I wrote Secrets of the Highlands, which was the second one, the publisher, no one had any idea what was going to be in those books until I delivered the manuscript. And so that was kind of fun. When I finished Battle of Lion Rock, I sent a text to my the main person at the publishing house. And all I said was, I finished writing Battle of Lion Rock. I can't believe how it ends. And that's how the text ended. So she texts me back and she's like, you're such a jerk. And I'm like, okay. Yeah. So, but yeah, so it's been super fun, you know, and I'm kind of at that stage, you know, with the project where it's like, you know, when you first have an idea and it sits in your imagination for so long. And then at the end, you know, we've written the trilogy now. At the end, now you're looking back at like, wow, how did all that happen? How did it all come together? So,
yeah. I mean, it's funny. Readers probably don't think it happens to writers, but it's the best thing when you're writing and the characters surprise you and the turn of events surprises you. And you're sort of in this gray area between writer and reader and enjoying the novel and the story.
Yeah. You know, someone asked me the other day, they're like, do you outline the books? Like, how do you keep track when you're writing a series? And I didn't outline at all in the Beacon Hill series. But what I did is when we had the first book was finished, I did what I'm calling reverse outlining. So I didn't outline. Once I got through book one, I went back and outlined the whole first book in a spreadsheet so that when I got to the second book is a fast reference. But I just, anytime I've tried to outline and stick to it, you know, I'll spend a month, I'll outline the whole story. And then like the first week of writing, you're like, the whole outline just blew up and I just wasted a month, you know, putting it together. So,
which sort of makes sense when you think about it, because it's only really when you're writing that the characters start to come alive and take shape, and then that prompts you. I mean, it almost does feel like the characters themselves make their own decisions at some point when you're in the flow. But I think that makes sense to me, that once you're writing, that's when it's not going to stick to a spreadsheet.
Yeah. And you feel like, for me, like, you know, you feel like you have the voices going in your mind, the conversations are happening, you know, my chapters in the books are always pretty short, kind of like scenes in a film. So you're imagining all that. And once I can play a scene out in my mind with the dialogue and everything, then I'll write it, you know? Mm-hmm. And so in a way, even my writing schedule, you know, I know a lot of writers stick to a certain schedule. I'm more of like a binge writer where it's like, I might not write for a few days, but I'm playing this movie in my mind. And once I get on it, once I get on the story, then I just go, you know, and I'm not thinking, well, I'm going to write for 2 hours today. I'm going to write till I don't have anything else happening in my brain, you know. But some days you're just, you know, you're going through, like, we run a production company, so we're working on other projects, but I've got this story playing in my mind the entire time. So it is kind of a weird, it's like a weird dynamic because you're in like two worlds all the time.
Yeah. And do you literally sit there and write through, or do you sort of do 45 minutes and then stretch your legs and, or do you?
I'll power through. Like once I sit down to write, then I'm going. Kind of my peak writing time really is nine at night till midnight. That's like
Okay.
that's kind of my window. And then the rest of the day, with everything else we're doing, or if I'm working on another book or whatever, I'm still thinking about, like Battle of Lion Rock was consuming because not only is now you've built the world out in two books, so now the world is like alive in your imagination, but everything that got set up in the first two books, now they have to pay off in the third book. So it was a little bit of creativity meets like landing the plane, So it's
Yeah.
like you could be creative, but you also have that list of all the threads and storylines to wrap up before it's done.
Yeah. I'd rather my pilots weren't too creative when they were,
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
coming
literally.
into Heathrow. So
Oh my gosh.
the book itself, young adult fantasy, are there themes in there? Have you tried to, I always think, when you think back to the classics and the C.S. Lewis's and so on, they do tend to have themes aimed at younger people who are developing their sort of take on the world. Have you done that with this series?
Yeah, big kind of a big theme through the whole series is redemption. For Jack, who's our main character, where he begins in Hunt for Eden Star, where he ends in Battle of Lion Rock, that's a he's had a totally transformative journey, and it's redemption for the losses he's experienced, and it's redemption for the friendships that he's built at that age. And then probably the other big theme to me would be it's that friendship piece where, I think back to when I was that age, and I was born and raised in Hong Kong, so I went to an international school in Hong Kong at that same age range. And those friends that I had then are like lifelong friends. And you realize how much of your like friend circle and how much of your who you are as you get older gets shaped during that time. And I think growing up in Hong Kong, being able to travel around the world, having friends of all different cultures and backgrounds, and it's definitely shaped kind of my storytelling bent. And then just my career overall in the entertainment space, I love working with like just a diverse group of people, in general.
Does a version of Hong Kong appear in this novel? Has that influenced your location?
Oh, big time. So, Hunt for Eden Star, we find Jack returning to Hong Kong to the school that they're all part of. So, Beacon Hill, which is the name of the series, there is a real Beacon Hill, and it's the grade school that I went to in Hong Kong. And we kind of mix like three different schools together to create the Beacon Hill in the series. And then a lot of the characters in the series are based off of friends that I've grown up with, even starting back in those time frames. And so that part was fun because it was almost like going back down memory lane. So where we take readers, especially in Hong Kong, it's not just to the tourist spots, it's to the back alleyways and the outdoor markets and like all the spots that I remember growing up. And then, as the series evolves, it takes the readers through Asia and like other countries that I've been to. So even writing about those, knowing I've walked those roads, I've been in those on those streets, like that part was super fun to write.
And the trilogy, or the, as you say, it's a trilogy, so book three marks the end of that. Is that absolutely the end of that? I mean, I come from the indie world where 15 books in a series isn't too unusual, but
Yeah.
for you, this is done.
I will say here's a good way to answer this diplomatically is the publisher signed on for a trilogy. I've left enough room in the series that I would love to keep writing that series. So I left enough room at the end where it can keep going. You know, I always thought it could be at least, you know, 5-6 books. And when we sold it as a trilogy, I kind of like compressed everything down and had to take certain things out that I would have liked, you know, certain storylines that would have been fun to explore. So I'm leaving it open. I'm like, I love that world. And so I know what the next book would be in that world if it was ever get written. So we'll, you know, we'll see how it plays out with everybody.
And does that rely on it being picked up by the same publisher or another publisher, or would you consider independently publishing?
You know, I've indie published and I've been traditionally published. And here's what I've learned over the years, and I'm sure, like, you know, this, you're well aware of it, is for the author, it's the exact same amount of work. And so you have to write the books, you know, as an indie, then you have to hustle to do the marketing and all the branding and all that. Well, in kind of where the environment is now, even in the publishing world, the traditional publishing side, everything you'd have to do as an indie, you're still going to have to do that, even with a traditional house. And so I'm open to, you know, if the publisher doesn't want to continue on with the series, then as far as I know, the way we've structured the deal is I could write another Beacon Hill book and just put it out on my own or go with another publisher, you know, something along those lines. We'll have to see how it plays out, obviously, for, you know, how the books sell. We've done really well the last year and a half, you know, where a lot of focus now is like push to Amazon, like just get it sold through Amazon. Beacon Hill has been, and my other series has sold well on Amazon. Beacon Hill was an interesting experience because early on with Hunt for Eden Star, we did a big push with Barnes and Noble, and they got behind the book, the initial book and the second one. So last year I did 30 dates with them. So we've seen the series sell through Barnes and Noble, you know, probably 90%, you know, over and above what Amazon's done. So wow. That's been an interesting thing because, you know, everyone has a template they follow. And I've been in the entertainment space long enough to know when something's working, you put fuel on that fire and you push it out. And, you know, my other series does way better on Amazon. So then we focus that series on the Amazon outlets, you know.
30 dates. With,
yeah, that was rough.
Yeah, I mean that sort of backs up what you just said about, you know, the marketing doesn't stop on a traditional contract.
Yeah, we with the dates with Barnes and Noble last year, we put out Hunt for Eden Star and Secrets of the Highlands in the same year. We sold out every signing except for one, which was Easter weekend. And I was like, I can't compete with Easter. So, you know, that's not going to happen.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But we had, you know, 29 straight dates where we went into the stores, we sold out. I think the series is in about 500 of the Barnes and Noble stores right now. So, but James, the interesting thing about that for all the indie guys out there, that piece, we had built our own Barnes and Noble database with every customer relations manager. So we called every store. We let them know ahead of time the series is coming. They did their pre-orders. A couple of weeks before the tour was going to start, Barnes and Noble had sold out on the books in the stores. And so we did a lot of groundwork apart from the publisher. And then we put the tour together and marketed the whole thing. Like, we did a lot of that on our own. And having the database obviously helped, you know, to be able to do it quick.
Yeah, a lot of work. Well, but targeted and efficient work that gave you results, which is great. Smart work. Let's talk about your TV side,
sure.
DJ. So you have a I mean, you're listed here as an executive producer and a director, and I think you said you have a production company. Just tell us about that side of your life.
Sure. I can tell you about it pre-COVID and post-COVID, because the industry is drastically changing. Pre-COVID, kind of our niche was executive producing and directing mostly unscripted shows. And so whether it was interview shows, pilots for reality shows, you know, we've done, I've executive produced and directed close to 600 episodes of television. And then through the production company, we have come alongside other producers that have like a show idea, and we help them figure out how do you turn this idea into a pilot, you know, and go out with them and pitch it to the studios, the networks, putting their budgets, you know. So we kind of found that niche. And we did, I think, a couple of years leading up to COVID, we had done like 12 pilots for other producers. And then when COVID hit, we had just shot a show. And so we were in post-production for about a year and a half on this other show, which kept the production company running when everything else shut down, you know. And during that time is when I signed the Beacon Hill deal. I had another book that I wrote called King of the Night, which just came out in September that we had finished up. So post-COVID, I've been doing a lot more writing than television producing. And we've been like Beacon Hill, we're shopping it around to the studios. So there's a lot of work that goes into that part of it, you know. So I haven't done any episodes of television for a couple of years, but you know, it's the industry's shifting and everyone's trying to figure out where they're going to land at the end of it, you know.
You're not in a position to sort of DIY Beacon Hill. You can't. I mean, is this something you can produce or?
Yeah, I think my only concern with that would be that because it, the way the story unfolds, the cities, you know, just if I look at a production side, the cities, just to film in Hong Kong, like that's a massive undertaking. Yeah. And then the characters go into other realms. So now you have all the CGI and all that gets tied into it. So it would have to be a situation where we either partner up with another production company and, you know, and I've been around this long enough to know most of the time authors get an option and then they're, you know, they're like, hey, we'll see you at the premiere, you know? Mm-hmm. Because of some of my credits and some of the writing stuff I've done, my hope would be if it ever did get optioned that I'm at least in the room when we're putting it together, you know, and that I can't ask for anything more because I'm sure there's, you know, directors and producers that could take this to the next level. But we've had some interesting conversations, everything from features to episodic streaming series to animation. So, you know, a lot of it will have to, I think we've had these conversations over the last couple of years. So when Hunt for Eden Star came out, we had a bunch of conversations, then everything settles down. We had the strike that we dealt with. Then Secrets of the Highlands came out. So we had another little spike in conversations and then that dies down. And I think everyone's wanting to see how does Battle of Lion Rock end, to see if, okay, we have a full trilogy that we can work with, you know, if I've done my job, hopefully that's what happens.
And did you write it with screenplay in mind?
Yeah. I mean, for me, I always thought this would be a great, you know, if everyone's got an opinion, but if I had my thought, I always thought this could be a great streaming series. So, you know, to make it into a feature, I mean, that's such a big mountain to climb. But I have, as I wrote it, I kind of wrote each book as a season. And so, you know, I'm like, yeah, that could definitely be a 10-episode, you know, 8 to 10-episode season. And even if you stretch the books out to maybe like a 5-season arc, you know, that could be possible.
Yeah. It's pretty, I mean, that's generally, I think, a good way of writing anyway, even if it's not specifically to have something turned into a production. But we're so used to some of the best writing you see is that TV writing and those big series. It's not a bad blueprint for those of us trying to aspire to better writing.
Well, and I've found, James Patterson, he writes real short chapters, and the more, but I like Michael Connelly. I've noticed his chapters seem to get a little shorter now. Like everyone's tightening
Harlan Coben
up.
Definitely as well.
Yeah. Everyone's tightening up that thing. And, they're even tightening up, where I've read some authors recently where literally the book is the action, the dialogue, and there's not a whole lot of setting descriptions, it's kind of like how you would write a script anyway. But I've noticed that everyone's trying to get to the heart of that scene quicker,
Now, TJ, I don't read somewhere that you've created a writing aid, a sort of app or something to help writers. I'm sorry, I don't have the details here, but can you tell us about that?
Oh, sure. So Writer Life, we put that out earlier this year. And it's kind of an on-demand coaching app. And so it, everyone can go through it at their own pace. It's mostly kind of audio lessons at this point. We haven't kind of moved into the video side yet. And it just gives them some tools that people can use to go through kind of the writing process. And then after that process, because a lot of times, especially for indies, there is that thought of, wow, if I write a book and a publisher picks it up, they'll take care of everything from that point forward. And that's just not the reality, So even kind of helping to coach people through, once that book is done, now what happens? What do you do from that point forward? How do you approach your cover design? Where, say with covers, for example, it used to be just you want to make sure the cover looks good on the shelf in a store. Well, now you've got to make sure the cover looks good as a postage stamp, because that's what people are going to see when they're scrolling through on Amazon or wherever else. So even kind of walking authors and creatives through that side of it, of now you've created the product. Now, what do you do from that point forward to really maximize the reach of the product?
Okay, I want to finish off with asking you about something that's in the series. In fact, funnily enough, I read a thread on social media from a guy called The Culture Critic, who does very good threads about the Christian artifacts.
Yeah.
And I realized how much of the medieval period was spent by bold knights on horseback, slaying a lot of people, trying to get a shard of wood that was allegedly part of the cross or something, whatever, this hugely valuable assets. Now, this is a theme in your book as well, isn't it? This sort of the artifacts, but in your case, I'm guessing they have some powers.
Yeah, my for Jack, for instance, he's on the hunt to find Eden Star in book one, and then that ends up bringing him to the other artifacts, which all have supernatural powers to them. I wanted to kind of walk a fine line between, I see the series as a general market series. And so while there's elements of faith in there, I wanted, first and foremost, I wanted the series to be entertaining for readers. But I did pull from, areas that I've been raised in and artifacts that I've learned about growing up. But taking it to a different stage, so it's not like if I was thinking of certain artifacts that we pull from might have kind of that biblical base, but I'm definitely not pulling from the biblical side as far as what they will do. I'm not saying this is factual. I'm taking inspiration from a lot of that, and creating my own artifacts that they, that Jack and his crew end up finding in the series.
Yeah, I guess a bit like Indiana Jones. I mean, they had the kind of Christian artifacts, but that was it, as they were objects that although because they did have some special powers at the end, yeah, melting Nazis.
Well, and the thing that kind of my goal is I want readers from every kind of walk of life to enjoy the series. And if you're a Christian, you're going to read it through one lens. If you're someone who's not walking, that same path, you're still going to read it and be entertained by not only the action, the artifacts, the worlds, but also, the connection between the characters. Because that was, for me, I wanted to write the characters as like a melting pot, because that's what I grew up with in Hong Kong, was all my friends, were from every part of the world. And that, I love that part, And when I came back to the States, I live in LA, you still have that melting pot in a sense, but so many parts of the world, it's like everyone's in their own kind of group, And I love being in the room with people from all walks of life, which is cool.
Yeah. All sort of siloed more these days. So here's the question then. If you could find an artifact, stumble across it, what would that be? What powers would it have?
Oh, man.
It's your final question, so
you've
got to have one tough question in the interview.
I'm like, wait a minute. They were so easy so far. I would say there's an artifact in the Beacon Hill series. It's a sword. It's called Dragon Soul. I would want to find that and put that thing to use, because that was probably one of my favorite in the series. And I'm like, yeah, if that thing really existed, I'd want to get my hands on that, I think.
That's like 10-year-old me wanting the green lightsaber, I guess.
Yeah, that's so true. I want one of those too, actually.
Yeah, of course, who doesn't? DJ, look, it's been fabulous talking to you. Really, best of luck with the series, and I hope one way or another you do get to continue it, because it seems like it's got some legs, as I think you probably say in Hollywood. It's got legs.
Oh, that's awesome. James, thanks for having me on. Fingers crossed it keeps going and we get one of the studios to kind of jump on board too.
Perfect. Thank you very much, DJ. I enjoyed that very much.
Oh, man. James, thanks, man. That was good. That was fun. You know how it is? So even though the book's coming out in January, I finished writing it last year, and then I've written like two books in between. So it's like a mind bender, because you're like, okay, wait a minute. Make sure I get everything right. Get all the artifacts right. So
yeah, trying to remember what it was. Oh, that must be the same. I often think of the actors when they do the junkets. It can be 2 years, can't it, since they were on set filming.
Yeah, and then someone's asking you like about some line that you gave in a scene, and they're just like, I don't even remember saying that. You know what I mean? They're like, wait a minute. They're like, I'm doing something else. You know what I heard the other day? Well, yesterday. I don't know if it's hit the news yet, but. So Denzel. So did you know Denzel Washington is going to retire?
Oh, is he?
So he's slotted out like his next 5 movies. And once he's done, he's done.
Wow.
Isn't that crazy? Like to think like, I'm thinking I'm going to hopefully write till I'm in my 80s,
I don't know what retirement really means for me, but.
Yeah. And it's like he came out and he said, I've got these 5 on the roster. Once these are done, I'm out of here. I'm like, wow, that's amazing.
Good for him. I'm sure he'll find something to do.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's true. All right, awesome. Well, have fun in Vegas.
Yeah, thank you. All right, DJ.
We'll see you. Bye.
So are you still friends with your elementary school friends?
No.
A couple.
Yeah. I talked to one, about 15 years ago. That's probably the last I think I've done that.
Yeah. I moved between 6th and 7th grade. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
I did too, but somehow we reconnected. Facebook, I guess, probably, But yeah, there's still people in my life that have known me my entire life. Church. Church is the reason. I grew up in a church. Mm-hmm. And so all those people, they track you down. You can't get away from your original church group.
Boy, does that sound ominous.
They don't let you go. Every time I think I've escaped, they pull me
Way
back
to
in and
sell religion,
baptize me.
Kevin's new book, Youth Group, a chiller.
Youth Group. Oh, that's a great title. Okay. Yeah, that has to be written.
So I thought it was interesting that DJ was talking about reverse outlining, because actually Jen and I were talking about this yesterday. Do you reverse outline ever when you get to the end of a book?
Obviously, you know I do.
Yeah, I need to spreadsheet stuff, so I talk about this too. So
I've never tried this before.
Oh, yeah, it's a really fun practice, because you just sort of I like it for creating the synopsis, actually, because, you know, if you're querying, you have to create a synopsis, which is like just distilling everything in your book into one page. And so I'll just go through, and as I'm reading, I'll just read the book like as a reader and just kind of write down a couple sentences, the main points that happen in each chapter. And then I like to compare it to my first outline just to see, you know, make sure that it lines up, make sure I didn't forget anything. And usually you can tell, like, oh man, I forgot that important element, or, you know, oh, there's this here, but I didn't really bring it to the end, so I need to figure out how to do that. I just feel like it's a really useful exercise in like really highlighting the editing process, I guess, just really sort of pulling it forward. And then it's also really helpful if you haven't touched the book for a while. So if you had to put it on hold for whatever reason, or even if you like get it back from a beta reader or an editor or an agent or whoever has it, then you can go back in and make sure that.
Yeah.
You know,
that seems like a good task for AI.
I was just about to say, I'm actually consulting with the guys from Plotter right now. And they've created something called Story Snap, which they'll be rolling out pretty soon. But it does this kind of thing, and I know that they're looking for people to test it. They ran one of my books, and it was so cool to see.
I've used the different tools, but I will say this: like, it can be a useful tool, but you know, shortcuts typically don't pay off in the end.
Yeah, there's something to be said for doing it yourself. We were talking about this because I totally forgot what happened on the book I was working on. And I was like, I have no memory of this place. And Jen was like, try reverse outlining. So.
Yeah, because if you put it through the AI, especially if you've had, you know, some distance with the manuscript, I mean, you still have to do the work. Like, you still have to read through it. You still have to make sure that it accurately captured everything. Like, you still have to do it. So for me, it just feels like, I mean, maybe it's an interesting addition to test the AI, but I don't really care about testing the AI. Like, I have to do the work anyway, so I might as well just do the work and be happy with that. I don't know.
Speaking as someone who's made a career out of using shortcuts for everything, I disagree with everything.
Well, let me ask you this. Do your characters come alive while you're outlining or not until you're writing?
While I'm writing, that's when they come to life.
Outlining.
Yeah. I see them while I'm outlining. Like,
yeah.
Outlining. I very clearly hear their voice and personalities.
Yeah.
I'm gonna say that with the book that JD and I are doing, I did see the characters come to life.
Because JD made you. He's like, write me about your characters before we
start. Yeah, yeah. Well, there is a component of that, but it's also like I've started really like outlining has been challenging for me, because I've got a whole career of not outlining. But I started to realize, like, okay, I'm seeing the character in shorthand, but I'm still seeing those little tells that they have that, you know, end up being translated outward. And kind of, you know, amplified in the rest of the book. So it's been an interesting learning experience.
Yeah.
I'll say.
I always feel like I know my character outlining, like I've got a sense of them, but then those first three chapters, I usually realize I don't, and I have to find a voice. So I feel like I know them, but then I know them better through the writing, I guess, if that makes sense.
I think it kind of depends. I mean, I think it's like, I always try to look at it like when you meet someone at a cocktail party, like sometimes you like click with someone, right? And you like kind of know who they are, but you don't like know them until you kind of like really start thinking about things. But I guess because I do my outlining in layers, so it's like the external plot. I always outline an internal plot, and then I'll go through and outline what the themes are and the archetype journeys for each character. And so, like, by the time I get to that, like, I kind of have a pretty good picture of who that person is and why they need to make plot decisions that make sense for their internal journey. And so it's sort of a more I kind of know them really well. Like I've gone through the outline a few times by then. So by
Yeah.
the time I sit down and write, like they're people.
I mean, at the minimum, I always have at least a couple of paragraphs about each person before I start writing. A lot of times I'll assign a real person to that character, you know, like an actor or an actress or somebody in my life, and just kind of steal their characteristics until, you know, at some point it kind of blends and they kind of take on their own personality, but it always gives me a good jumping off point to make them seem, you know, at least a little bit unique, even at the outlining stage. Because if I don't know the characters and I'm outlining, like I don't know their reactions. And you know, like one character should react differently than another character, and if they're not, then I think you need to go back and better define the characters.
And those little things really matter, and they really like help as a reader, like really pull you in, like, 'cause you're not just reading words on a page anymore. You're like, what is this person going to do? And like, oh, what, like you start to really feel connected to them when they have those little quirks and tells. It's really important, I think.
I still discover the character 99% via what they do and what they say. Like I don't go in knowing everything about a character except the ones I've written for years.
There's nothing wrong with that. I think we all do that. I think it's important then, like when you get to the end, to go back and kind of run through the beginning to make sure you bring the character fully up to speed, because like they may be 50% developed at one point, now they're 70%. By the time you finish, they're at 100. You know, you've got to even all that out.
Here's a question for you, because I had to do this. I just experienced this, but I had two different characters, and they weren't really similar, except for they shared like one like sort of personality trait. And then I realized by the end, that I didn't need both of them. I really just needed one of them, so I combined them. Have you ever had to do something like that?
Oh,
I do it all the time.
All right, good.
yeah.
I didn't know if that meant something.
It means you have an unnecessary character, is what it means.
I mean, a lot of times you may think a character is going to have a much bigger role in the story than they actually do. And, you know, like if they just turn out for a couple of pages and, you know, you felt they should be bigger, you can fold that into somebody else. I've dealt with it a lot on the TV and film side too, because they're always trying to drill down that cast and get it a little bit smaller. So they're, you know, like that's one of the first things they look at is which characters can be combined. I always try to keep it in mind though, as I'm writing, if somebody doesn't feel like they're 100% there and they don't need to be there, a lot of times you can just absorb into that character into somebody else.
They have to serve a purpose for the plot. Like everything I think that shows up on the page has to be relevant in a not minor way to the plot. Otherwise you have to either like kill them off on the page or kill them off the page and like never have them appear on the page.
Jenna kills anybody who doesn't fit into her particular situation. Just kill them off.
Fictionally.
With
Fictionally,
a
whatever.
yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, it was interesting hearing him talking about the TV and film writing too. And then he said, scenes are getting shorter. Get to the heart of the scene earlier. And I was thinking about that. Any thoughts on what does that mean? Get to the heart of the scene earlier.
I mean, for me, like I do a lot of that in the editing, and this came from working with Patterson, but like I'll take the chapter and a lot of times I will chop off whatever happens at the end of the chapter, because it creates more of a cliffhanger leading into the next one. A lot of times I'll do the same thing at the beginning. You know, I think when you're trying to get to the heart, that's literally what you're doing. You're trimming away both ends of it. A lot of authors, you know, myself included, when you sit down to write it, a chapter, you try to create a beginning, middle, and an end. But that, you know, that serves the purpose of storytelling, but it doesn't, you know, keep those pages turning. And when you're writing thrillers, you need to keep the pages flipping. So a lot of times taking out a little bit will actually speed up the whole storytelling process.
I find that I am adding too much exposition in the middle that's happening sort of off camera kind of thing, or in a character's head or whatever. So I'm having to kind of discipline myself to cut those darlings, because it's not that they serve a purpose, but I've started kind of reading back through some of these scenes and thinking, okay, yeah, it's cool that the reader knows that and it helps, but they don't have to know it in order for the scene to work. And so this is a good thing. You know, this is a good, you know, sometimes 500 words or so to cut, you know, and really sharpen a chapter. That's been tough because, you know, my past books have had a lot of that. My readers like it, you know, they like knowing the details. So I've always added that stuff, but I'm taking a new approach. And so, you know, that part of that approach is like just trim things to make it all tighter. That's what I'm trying to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's like, you know, there's styles and all that. I was actually just in an interview that's coming up. One of the authors I was talking to had documentary experience, and they said that they learned that exact thing through that, you know, you don't have to like necessarily have like a sweeping intro, that you can just like start at the door slamming or a piece of dialogue. Like you can really sort of cut a lot of those things that are very cool and maybe help the reader, you know, see the world in a different way. But do they need to? And that's an interesting question to ask yourself, I think, as you're writing. Do you really need that? Or is it okay that the reader works a little bit harder in that aspect?
I'm thinking of from now on writing a parallel book to every book that just contains all the scenes that I cut.
You should sell it. Give it away on your website.
Yeah.
Back in my book doctor days, I almost always cut the first chapter of a book that I was working on. Almost every book seemed to start better with chapter two. And my pink highlighter was always the one I used for exposition. So I would have a printed copy of the book, any exposition in the book, I'd highlight in pink. And then I would go back through and try to take each one of those blocks of text and find some other way to work it in. And just like you said, Kevin, a lot of times you've got 500 words there describing something. You could probably describe it in 10 words or less, you know, if you fit it in somewhere else, you know, which makes everything move a little bit better.
So with the word count for like trad, because they want those books, 80,000 words. It's different if you're indie, but for trad, they want that 80,000 words typically. So does that change the way you write the stories then? Like if you're getting so lean, does it change the way you plot or your story, or not really?
I've never come up short, you know, like I always end up writing long anyway. So
I think it's easier to cut than it is add in some ways, but one trick, I don't remember where I heard this, but I do remember hearing, and it was in particularly with sci-fi and fantasy, but they said, if you can take a description and it works outside of the scene, it's too long. And so however you're describing something, it has to connect directly to the scene in order not to be exposition. And I thought that was a really interesting, like that stuck out in my head as like, right, like, the reader should read it and maybe understand what they're seeing, but not understand the context.
Yeah, that's good advice. And it needs to be scene dependent.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
The scene would fall apart without it. That needs to be in there. But it would fall apart without the scene is equally important.
Yeah, I 100%. Yeah. And I think that helps because it really does make you look at what you're writing to say, like, is this necessary and how do I make it necessary?
Yeah. That's a good tip. And we've established you are all overly verbose. So cutting 500 words a chapter doesn't matter.
Yeah. That's probably a good generalization to make for sure. Yeah.
Perfect. All right. With that, JD, who is up this week?
Next week, we've got Adrian Jakovsky coming on. Adrian's a British science fiction and fantasy author who has won both the Arthur C. Clarke Award and the BSFA Award. His new novel is titled Days of Shattered Faith and releases March 4th. Adrian Jakovsky.
Sounds great. If you'd like to be notified as soon as new episodes publish, make sure you go to writersincpodcast.com and sign up now. We'll see you next episode and have a great week of writing.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Writers Inc. Access the show notes and leave a comment at writersincpodcast.com.